Memoirs of the Reverend George Whitfield, Chapter 17. From opening the chapel in Tottenham Court Road to his arrival in Edinburgh in the year 1759. His constant work was now preaching about 15 times a week, which, with a weak appetite, want of rest, and much care lying upon his mind, reduced him to a state of great bodily weakness. "But yet," says he, "the joy of the Lord is my strength, and my greatest grief is that I can do no more for him who has done and suffered so much for me." His new chapel succeeded according to his wish. On Sunday mornings, hundreds went away, not being able to get in. Several people of rank were desirous of obtaining constant seats, and a very affecting letter was received from one under conviction, who acknowledged that curiosity alone brought him first to see what sort of a place it was. Footnote: a neighboring doctor calls the place Whitfield's soul trap. "I pray the friend of sinners to make it a soul trap indeed to many wondering creatures." Shudder the place, the prayer always makes one of the auditory, and as I hear, is much impressed and brings others with him. End of the footnote. It is said that Humes was a hearer of Mr. Whitfield, and was much taken with his eloquency. Such testimonies as the latter are recorded merely for their singularity. Footnote: an intimate friend of the infidel Hume, that's H-U-M-E, asked him what he thought of Mr. Whitfield's preaching, for he had listened to the latter part of one of his sermons at Edinburgh. "He is, sir," said Mr. Humes, "the most ingenious preacher I have ever heard. It is worthwhile to go 20 miles to hear him." He then repeated the following passage, which he heard towards the close of that discourse. After a solemn pause, Mr. Whitfield thus addressed his numerous auditory: "The attendant angel is just about to leave the threshold and ascend to heaven. And shall he ascend and not bear with him the news of one sinner amongst all this multitude, reclaimed from the error of his ways?" To give the greater effect to this exclamation, he stamps with his foot, lifted up his hands and eyes to heaven, and with gushing tears cried aloud, "Stop, Gabriel, stop, Gabriel, stop ere you enter the sacred portals, and yet carry with you the news of one sinner converted to God." He then, in the most simple but energetic language, described what he called a Savior's dying love to sinful man, so that almost the whole assembly melted into tears. The address was accompanied with such animated, yet natural action that it surpassed anything I ever saw or heard in any other preacher. Happy had it been for poor Hume had he received what he then heard as the word of God and not as the word of man. End of the footnote. In 1757, he again took his circuit northward and came to Edinburgh sometime in the month of May. And at the time of the annual meeting of the General Assembly, a circumstance which afforded him much satisfaction. His preaching was attended by many ministers, it is said 100 at a time. Many of them appeared to be deeply affected, and thus their prejudices were removed. About 30 of them, as a proof of their regard, invited him to a public entertainment. His Majesty's Commissioner, Lord Cathcart, also invited him to his table, and his lordship's predecessor, the Earl of L, showed particular attention to Whitfield, as indeed he had constantly done from the time of his first coming to Scotland. Multitudes, and great many of them of the highest rank, daily flocked to hear him. The congregation still increased more and more. Leaving Edinburgh, he arrived at Glasgow on the 8th of June, having preached twice by the way, and continued preaching as usual till the 14th, in the high churchyard, two large congregations twice a day, in both forenoon and afternoon, in a church in the city. Seeing the pitiable condition of the poor of Glasgow were in at this time, notwithstanding the bounty of the affluent and humane, he, with the concurrency of the magistrates, at his sermon on Monday evening, made a collection for them, amounting to nearly 60 pounds. Next day, he preached at Paisley, and immediately set out for Ireland. His reception in Dublin was as promising as formerly. The congregations were very large, and a blessing appeared to attend his preaching, many being much affected. A certain prelate told a noble lord that he was glad Whitfield had come to rouse the people. Persons of all ranks attended, and all seemed, in some measure, affected with the solemn truths which he delivered. On Sunday afternoon, having preached in Oxmantown Green, a place much frequented by large parties of the Ormond and Liberty Boys, as they were called, or who often fought there, he very narrowly escaped with his life. It being wartime, he had earnestly exhorted his hearers, as was his usual practice, not only to fear God, but also to honor the king, and pray for the success of his Prussian magistrate's arms. While he was preaching, and earnest in prayer, some stones were thrown at him, which providentially did him no harm. But when he had done endeavoring to return the way that he came, by the barracks, to his great surprise, access was denied, so that he was obliged to walk near half a mile over the green, through some hundreds of rioters and buffoons, who, perceiving him to be alone, four preachers and a soldier, having deserted him and fled, threw stones, showers of stones upon him from every quarter, which made him reel backwards and forwards, till he was almost breathless and covered with a gorge of blood. Footnote: I received many blows and wounds. One was particularly large and near my temples. I thought of Stephen, and was in hope, like him, to go off in this bloody triumph, in the immediate presence of my master. He used to say, in speaking of this event, that in England, Scotland, and America, he had been treated only as a common minister of the gospel, but that in Ireland he had been elevated to the rank of an apostle, in having had the honor of being stoned. End of the footnote. At length, with a great difficulty, he staggered to the door of the minister's house, near the green, which was humanely opened to him. For a considerable time he remained speechless and gasping for breath, but his weeping friends, having given him some cordials and washed his wounds, procured a coach, in which, amongst volleys of oaths, horrid imprecations, and violent threatenings of the ramble, he came safe home, and joined in a hymn of thanksgiving with his mourning, yet rejoicing friends, of whom he says, "None but spectators could form an idea of the affection with which I was received." Footnote: it was under this sermon that the late Reverend John Edwards was impressed with the great importance of religion. Whitfield, in the sermon alluded to, addressed the consciences of the people with such particular energy and success that Mr. E. thought every word was personally directed to him, though he had concealed himself from the preacher's view, and to him was entirely unknown. In what period of his life he entered on the work of the ministry, we cannot learn. Several years he preached in connection with Mr. Wesley, but some disagreeable circumstances existing in the Society of Leeds, he and a number of friends attached to him as the instrument of their spiritual knowledge and happiness, after much deliberation with each other and prayer to God, withdrew themselves and built another chapel, where he continued to dispense the word of life for more than 30 years. Before he settled at Leeds in the year 1755, he went about doing good after the example of friends of sinners. He endured the cross and despised the shame. In Ireland he traveled and labored much in the early part of the ministry, and the effects of his humble excursions to diffuse the knowledge of Christ were crowned with abundant success. At one time, while he resided in Dublin, as he was returning from preaching at a village, a party of rude fellows, composed of the Ormond boys, who used to assemble in the evening, recognized him as Swaddling John. Footnote: this term of reproach originated in the following circumstances. Soon after the introduction of Methodism into Ireland, the late Reverend John Cennick, C-E-N-N-I-C-K, was preaching in Dublin on a Christmas day. His text was Luke 2:12, "Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger." A drunken fellow who was listening at the door to pick up something by which he might ridicule this new religion which had not yet attained a name, hearing the word swaddling often repeated, ran along the street exclaiming with great vulgarity, "Oh, these people are swaddlers, they are swaddlers." The name quickly took and became the badge of OPPROBRIUM through Ireland. End of the internal footnote. A term of reproach applied to the Methodist preachers in Ireland and seized him with all the madness of their enmity against the truth he preached, declared they would throw him over the bridge into the Laffey. This was observed by an opposite party who had assumed the appellation of Liberty Boys, residing on the other side of the river. They immediately encountered his assailants, determined they would rescue him out of their hands. This they accomplished and carried him home in triumph, saying he was their swaddling done, for he lived on their side of the river, and none should hurt him. Thus God preserved his life and made both the wrath and ignorancy of men to praise him. At another time, having preached out of doors after he had finished his discourse, a furious mob of the white boys beset the house into which he had entered and threatened to burn it to the ground if he was permitted to continue in it. This desperate menace greatly alarmed the inhabitants, who were extremely unwilling to gratify their wicked desire. There was, however, but one way for his escape, and that was through a window which opened into a garden belonging to a justice of the peace, who was himself a bitter persecutor of the Methodists. Through this window he was let down in a basket. Here he stood some time in great consternation, fearing the family would observe him and charge him with having broken into their garden for bad purposes, and that thereby both himself and religion might be injured. At length he ventured to knock at the door, asking for the squire, and being introduced, ingeniously stated the circumstances of his distressed situation, which had such an effect on the magistrate's mind that he protected and entertained him at his house 2 days in a hospitable manner. He was sincere in all his pastoral engagements, deeply impressed with the vast importance of his work and greatly loved by his congregation. The salvation of souls excited his watchfulness, his prayers, and his zeal. And in his whole life he was an epistle of Christ, known and read by all men. Governed by a disinterested concern for the peace and prosperity of the people committed to his charge, he was instant in season and out of season, reproving, rebuking, and exhorting with all long-suffering and gentleness. And as a bird each fond and dormant tries to tempt its new-fledged offsprings to the skies, he tried each art, reproved each dull delay, allured to brighter worlds, and led the way. On the 17th of February, 1785, age 71, he bid goodbye to all his connections in this mortal life and entered into his eternal rest. End of the footnote. The next morning, though extremely weak, he sets out for Port Arlington, leaving, he says, my persecutors to their mercy, to his mercy, who, our persecutors, has often made preachers. I pray God I may thus be avenged to them. Having preached at Port Arlington, Athlone, Limerick, and Cork, in the beginning of August, he returned to England, and whenever the weather was favorable, continued to range, as he termed it, everywhere preaching with a great earnestness and apparent success as ever. This spiritual hunting, says he, is delightful sport when the heart is in the work. At Plymouth, he had the pleasure of seeing officers, soldiers, sailors, etc., attending divine worship with becoming reverency and delight. He enjoyed, also, delightful seasons in Exeter, Bristol, Colchester, and other towns, and about the middle of October, 1757, returned to London. By his unremittent attendance this winter at the chapel and the tabernacle, together with much study and care, his health became greatly impaired. Weakened as he was by continual vomitings, want of sleep, and loss of appetite, he, however, still went on as well as he could. "I am brought now," says he, "to the short allowance of preaching but once on weekdays and twice on a Sunday." When disengaged from his pulpit ministrations, He was ever projecting some plan or other for the advancement of religion, as the erecting of almshouses for religious widows on the ground which surrounded the chapel. "I have a plan," says he, "for 12. The whole expense will be £400. I have a prospect of 2. I propose allowing each widow half a crown a week. The sacrament money will more than do. If this be effected, many godly widows will be provided for, and a standing monument left that the Methodists were not against good works." In a short time, he put this plan into execution. February 16, 1758, the foundation of the almshouse was laid, and the widows began to be admitted in the June following. Footnote: to a gentleman who visited him in London in the year 1768, he pointed out those houses from the room in which they sat and said, "Those are my redoubts. The prayers of the poor women who reside in them protect me in my house." End of the footnote. His summer circuit this year, he began at Colchester, from whence he proceeded to Bristol and onward to Wales. During his stay in that country, his health was much on the decline, so that he could not set up in company as he had been used to do, and could take but little food. Yet notwithstanding his infirmities, he continued his journey through a great part of South Wales, incredible multitude attending his preaching wherever he went. In the month of July, he set off for Scotland. In his way, he preached at Everton and a bunch of other cities, including Newcastle. 4 clergymen led him their pulpits. His bodily strength so little increased by this journey that he frequently felt an inclination to turn back, but he did not think it consistent with his duty. "Through divine strength," says he, "I hope to go forward, and shall strive as much as in me lies to die in this glorious work." Yet through the divine blessing, his health was greatly increased soon after his return from Scotland. From Edinburgh, he writes, August 19th and August 24th. "For these 4 months past, I have been brought so extremely low in my body that I was in hopes every sermon I preached would waft me to my wished for home. Scotland, I hope, would finish my warfare, but it has rather driven me back to sea again. On Tuesday next, I thought to have moved, but as it is race week and my health is improving, friends advise me to stay, to stir them up to run with patience the race that is set before us." The following account appeared in the Glasgow Courant. Edinburgh, September 14, 1758. "Mr. Whitfield's presence at this time has been particularly useful to the Orphan Hospital, for which upwards of £200 has been raised from the collection at the doors and seat rents. Before he left Glasgow, he made a collection for the Glasgow Charitable Highland Society for supporting the Highland children, a scheme particularly useful at this time when so many of their parents and friends were abroad in America in His Majesty's service. During his stay here, he has had occasion to preach 3 Thanksgiving sermons for the victory of CREVELT and taking of Cape Breton and the late defeat of the Russians. By his warm and repeated exhortations to loyalty and a steady adherence to the Protestants' interests on this and all other occasions, it must be acknowledged, even in this view, his visit here has been useful to the community in a civil as well as a religious light. Having left Edinburgh, he preached with his usual abundant liberty and success in most of the principal towns in the north of England, and about the end of October arrived in London. His affairs in America being in a prosperous state, he now began to think of going over to Georgia again. "Blessed be God," says he, "that I can send you word a never-failing providence has put it in my power to pay off all the Setta's arrears. I am talking every day of coming over, but how to do it in wartime, or how to get the chapel and tabernacle supplied, I cannot as yet be clear in. Not being able, it seems, to get over these difficulties, he spent the winter in 1758 in London, and opened his spring campaign at Bristol. The month of June he spent preaching through Colchestershire and Yorkshire. People of all ranks and distinctions, everywhere, flocked, as usual, twice a day to hear him, and from thence revisited Scotland. End of chapter 17, having been read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God.